Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode number 420. 420, baby. And what better guest on 420 than a legendary writer of tales involving narcotics, Mr. Irvin Welsh. I was delighted to get to chat with Irvin. As I mentioned in the podcast, I got sent a little preview of his new show, Crime, which is on BritBox, all out now, a BritBox exclusive. I got sent the episodes and I was going to watch a couple in preparation because I've got plenty to talk to Irvin Welsh about, for God's sake. He made Trainspotting and Ecstasy and Acid House and just so much good shit. But then I ended up watching all six episodes and absolutely adoring it. It's great. I really enjoyed it. So yeah, we jumped on Zoom. We only had the Zoom recording. Normally I record separate ends. Again, it sounded fine, and Buddy Peace is the best podcast producer in the land. So you won't even notice, but I thought I'd pre-warn you of that. Yeah, as ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch and all the goodness. And patreon.com/scroobiouspip is where you can join the patron and support the podcast for like $1 a month or $1.50 or whatever it works out as, or a quid or whatever. So head over there and do that. But most importantly, enjoy this episode and then go and watch Crime on BritBox. This is episode 420 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Irvin Welsh. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm here today with Irvin Welsh. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. Are you enjoying? I saw a tweet that you seem to be enjoying the kind of the promo run that you're on at the moment, because they can be hit or miss, right? They can be exhausted, I mean, or laborious, but this seems like a fun one.
You have to just kind of, you know, knuckle down and barge through it, really. You know, there's not, it's you can, you know, it's just one of these things that you can't, you know, it's a good sign, because you realize that you've got to this point, it means you've actually got something out, so it becomes real, basically. Like, yeah,
I feel you. Well, obviously, I want to talk about Crime and loads of other stuff. We've got a good amount of time on this, so we can really get into it, but we've got an unusual connection. And I think we tweeted about it at one point, but there's someone out there who's got a tattoo that's a portrait of the two of us, which is unusual. It's
fabulous.
It's done by a guy called G Davis Art on Instagram, and you have to scroll back to like 2017. But it's like an optical illusion, so it looks like a skull. But then when you zoom in, it's you drinking a bottle of Monkey 47 gin, and me just stroking my beard and looking pretentious as I tend to do. So it's a strange link that we have.
Brilliant.
how have you found the kind of fandom thing over your career? Because you're an adored writer and creator. How have you found that with?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I've got used to it a bit now. It was kind of strange at first in the 90s, because I thought one of the benefits of being a writer is that nobody will recognise you. You know, you're just a face on a dust jacket.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know, you know, the visual recognition came to me quite quickly, even before the film. So it was quite a strange thing, you know, because, you know, when I was younger, I always craved that level of attention. Basically, I was a kind of sort of young, kind of narcissistic, sort of wannabe kind of musician and all that, you know, and I thought this would be great. And then, you know, when it happened, you know, it happened when I was 30 instead of 20. So it was like, oh, fuck, I don't really want this anymore. You know, so it's that kind of careful what you wish for thing. So I found it a bit difficult at first, because I was living quite a settled life, and I didn't want to be kind of sort of torn up and thrust into this kind of mad arena that fame and recognition are, you know. So, but I tried to avoid it as much as I could, and then I got, you know, I kind of sort of dipped my toe in it occasionally. But the good thing is that, you know, I've always been a working writer. I've always gone from one project to the next project. So yeah. I've never really had that much time to kind of bask in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Edinburgh is the location for Crime for Trainspotting, for a lot of your work, essentially. I love Edinburgh. Always have. I think it's such a beautiful city. I love the people of Edinburgh. I did the Fringe a good few years back, and my aunt came along, who has lived in Edinburgh her whole life, must have been over 50 at that point, and she came to see my show, had never been to a single Edinburgh Fringe show, and that's what I love about the people of Edinburgh. they're not interested in that nonsense. They were very much like my aunt and all of her people, like, yeah, this thing happens in August, which people think is Edinburgh, and people think of as Edinburgh because they come at one time a year, but the real city is a different place
altogether. Yeah, I mean, most of the locals is always like, oh, I can't get served in a pub properly, or, you know, can't, you know, sort of, fucking buses are too full and all this kind of nonsense. Yeah. Like, you know, so yeah, you do have a sort of a kind of ambivalent reaction to it. Like, you know, it's quite an amazing thing. All these kind of shows and events crammed into this kind of not a massive metropolis, but, you know, just crammed into this town, really, like, you know, and everywhere it's kind of being utilised. So it is, you know, there is a unique kind of buzz and vibe here. And I would say to anybody, like, it's something they should experience once, you know, at least in the life of Edinburgh Festival. But you do get blasé about it. I mean, I remember, like, when I was, I don't remember this actually, but when I was a kid, my mum kept a newspaper cutting, and it had a picture of her and my Auntie Joyce. They were both kind of in the Botanic Gardens, and me and my cousin Raymond were kind of both kind of like babies, basically, you know, and they were chain smoking. And it had like kind of, the headline was Outspoken Mum in the evening news. And my mum just saying, like, the festival's not for the likes of us, it's for all these rich fuckers that come into town and all that, you know, so the usual kind of thing. But it's a great headline, and the pair of them looked very kind of trashy glam, the kind of ivy hairs and their cigarettes and all that, and the sort of coats and sitting there. So I'm massively proud of that kind of that evening news sort of. And it was right, it was like a big headline kind of as well.
Yeah, Outspoken Mum is a wonderful word. That's a character.
Yeah.
I love that. So what was it like growing up in Edinburgh? Because as you say, you had a period of wanting to be a musician and being in bands and stuff, but a lot of places in the UK or anywhere outside of London, really, until more recent years, things like working in literature or the entertainment industry weren't necessarily pushed forward as viable options. So what kind of kid were you to kind of think, here's what I want to do?
Well, I mean, I think it was like, because I grew up, you know, I was born in Leith in a kind of, it was like the classic kind of tenement life, you know, by the, you know, in the dock area. Everything was geared around kind of three things. There was the docks, there was the, where my family worked in, and there was a merchant navy. And there was Rob Caledon Shipyard. So that was the kind of, that was the sort of three main influences. And I was always drawn more, as a kid, I was always drawn more to the sailor, the seamen's, like, because they had all the stories, like, you know.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, when you, as a kid, when you listened to all the older guys, you know, they weren't old guys, they were still quite young guys, but you saw them as old guys when you were a kid. And they had all the interesting stories. It was like the shipyard workers was all about kind of violence. It was all about stabbing because they're all tools, you know, guys on tools and all that. So they had that mentality. The dockers were all about thieving, but the merchant seamen is all about traveling to exotic places and kind of meeting exotic women and all that and getting all these, you know. So it just seemed to be a much more, it suited my kind of aesthetic kind of a lot more. So I listened to a lot of these tales. Then we moved down the estuaries. A lot of families did, you know, what they called the slum clearance. They first moved us down to the prefabs in Pilton, and then the Masonettes and Muirhouse. They were like, you know, that was a kind of, I didn't think about it in this way then, but Muirhouse was basically a kind of, in Pilton were like factories. You know, these schemes were like factory towns because it was like Parsons Peebles, Ferrantes, Bruce's, United Wire. They were basically there to service these industrial units, that were, you know, these factories that were out there. And when they shut down, you know, there's nothing left. So that was my kind of experience, was that very archetypal, really, like sort of Leith, North Edinburgh, kind of growing up in that place, like, you know, from tenement to scheme. And I've probably just been reading, Bobby Gillespie's wrote a book called Tenement Kid. And it's very, very resonant with me, because Bobby's a friend, but it's also that it's a similar kind of background, It's like you kind of start off in a tenement and then the tenements get knocked down and you move out to a scheme and, you're obsessed by music, basically. So I found that a really fascinating and kind of emotional book to read, basically, because all the stuff about the music and the clothes and all that kind of came back.
Yeah, I completely understand that, and I can imagine hearing all of that storytelling as you're growing up from different areas. Again, there was a guy I used to gig with a lot, a good friend of mine, a spoken word artist called Polar Bear. And he writes under the name of Stephen Camden now. And he used to say, because we'd all feel very uncomfortable at being referred to as poets or anything like that, because we were just like, well, like his argument was, I'm just doing what my nan used to do around the breakfast table, or around the dinner table. I'm just getting up and telling stories. Yeah. And it feels like if you've grown up around those working class storytelling gatherings.
I mean, I think here it comes from that kind of Celtic oral tradition, where they would never write anything down. But they would just, they would just come out with intricate storytelling. And I amassed all these stories and all the, and I just got into that way of thinking, that everybody was, there was always some, nothing could happen to someone without somebody else having an anecdote that was a big, long, winding kind of sort of elaborate tale. And I loved all that. I loved all that stuff.
Yeah, completely.
Sitting listening to it, as a kid, I would always be sneaking downstairs when I should be in my bed. I'd be hiding behind the couch. I'd be listening to all their tales and all that. And then when I couldn't wait. And, when I was in the playground or with your mates at school, I went to school to listen to my pals and to crack on with them. And to, I wasn't interested in anything teachers were saying. And none of us were. We just wanted to hang out with each other and talk a lot of shit about what we'd done the night before. And then I couldn't wait to get into a pub, because that gives you license to do all that. You just sit with your pals and you come out with all these kind of tales and moving south, I moved to London quite early and it was great to meet all these different people from not just from London but from all other parts of the UK and further afield, and listen to all their tales as well. It was just a massively enriching time.
I love that, and I love the, as you touched upon, the kind of local tales where if anything happens, everyone's got a long-winded story about it, and half the time the thing that's happened is a tiny part of their long-winded story. It's just an excuse to tell their actual other story. And I walk past that. All right, well, this isn't actually related.
It's massive. People don't realise that they are, the masses of embellishment that goes on. People don't realise that they're actually writing creative fiction as they're pushing this on,
So did that motivate you to write, I guess? Because it was your first book that just went crazy. It was Trainspotting that kind of blew up. And
I mean, it's funny because I was in different bands and I always liked writing ballads. I noticed that every song that I wrote was telling a story. So I mean, ballads are basically just short stories set to music, really, and I thought when the music wasn't working, I thought, well, just keep on with the stories. And I decided at one point, I thought, I'm not gonna do anything musically, but I might do something with all these kind of tales that I've got to tell, So I put them together and I thought there's a kind of make or break, really. I thought I'm gonna really put everything into this book. I'm really gonna go for it. And it was so strange because through being kind of so disappointed and having kind of doors slammed in my face and being knocked back with everything to do with music, making no headway at all, to suddenly just have a book published by the biggest publisher, kind of becoming a cult book, becoming a bestseller, becoming a big award-winning stage play, becoming an international film, and it was just like this almost overnight success. It was like I went from kind of having nothing to kind of being set up for life as a writer within 3 years, and I thought, well, this is just so strange, It's like I was so used to getting kind of knockbacks and rejections, and that's really what a writer's life is mostly like. I feel embarrassed when that's why I play up my kind of musical failure background, because I feel embarrassed when I talk to other writers and they say, they're all saying, oh, it took me years to get published, I had this book and I got rejected by every single publisher, and then I I redid it, and then it got rejected again, and then I redid it, and it got rejected again, and then somebody published it, and it kind of did well and all that, you know. And for me, it was instant. You know, the success was instant. It's incredibly rare and atypical, and I'm embarrassed about it in a sense. Yeah. So I always kind of go on about how I've paid my dues through rejection, through other in other mediums.
Yeah, I love that, and it broke through and got its place on very much on your terms. I remember at the time all the talk about it being very much Scottish dialect and not watered down or changed at all. And that's one of the things I loved about Crime is you're seeing real Scottish accents, Scottish turns of phrases and things like that, not a watered down kind of an affected Scottish accent. I spoke to Limmy about this a while back, about how he was kind of buried away on BBC Scotland for so long because it was kind of deemed the English won't understand this. It's too how will they translate your strange ways? So how important was that for you to have it feel properly Scottish? Not
I mean, I think that the kind of gatekeepers, for want of a better word, of the media, we kind of patronise the public a little bit about that kind of thing. I mean, it's like people in England have been vibing on Billy Connolly for years and years, and, you know, South Africa, Canada, there's not been any real problem. And I think sometimes people enjoy kind of experiencing something culturally different, having to work a little bit harder to access it. It's never really been an issue. And I think with Crime, it's like we were, you know, like Dougray being the sort of lead guy sort of set the, that's set because he's local to here. He's like kind of East Scotland kind of sort of Fife guy. So it set the kind of tone for it. And you had people like Jamie Sivis, who plays Gilman, was just, he wasn't going to compromise at all. Like, he's just I'm from Leith, and I can't understand him when he's ripping off like that. You know? So it's brilliant to, you know, and I think, again, it's like we had that benefit of the streaming platforms are great because you kind of, you know, if you're limited, like in Britain, in TV, even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, you were limited to terrestrial platforms. You're limited to kind of BBC, ITV, Channel 4, and there's a limit to what you can get away with, really. They have to be catch-all, and they have to be a kind of bit blanded out, the dramas there. So, but on the streaming platforms, it can come from a cultural place. You can be a bit more, you can be a bit more adventurous and a bit more honest and, you know, authentic about how you see what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, the two biggest global successes on Netflix have been Squid Game and Money Heist, not English or American. Yeah. Like, again, you wouldn't have thought that previously.
You've got a Spanish language and a Korean program, and it's like, it's funny, like, you know, the there's so much of it. It's like people will want, you know, they take an interest in things, and it's like they're much less prescriptive, and people, you know, people are just a bit more cosmopolitan than programmers give them credit for. I mean, 16-year-old upstairs, she says that, you know, you can't watch this in dubbed. You have to watch it subtitled in Korean and all that. So people, you know, I think people are much more sort of they're much more into that kind of diversity than we'd imagine.
Imagine half of the dialogue from the character of Dougie being dubbed. That would be terrible to not get his wonderful delivery and visceral anger and everything he does.
I would rather they did subtitles and dubbed him, because it's like you couldn't really, you lose the impact of him as a character.
Completely. So, I mean, so how was it writing this as a screenplay? Because it's adapted from your novel, but you and Dean Kavanagh have been the ones to adapt it as such. So how's that been process?
The novel was set in Miami, and we originally did the scripts based in Miami, but it was difficult to raise the money having an American, you know, a Scottish lead actor, a Scottish lead character in an American kind of drama, which it would have been. And, you know, because I was living in the States at the time, I'd been over there for 10 years, and we were trying to raise the money through contacts there. It was just proven to be such a pain to do it. You know, probably would have still been at it now. So what we did, we got together with a producer, Tony Wood, who was absolutely brilliant, and then Polly Hill, who was the head of drama at ITV, and she was really excited about BritBox, and she was saying, this is maybe the place for it. And then Tony had decided, said, well, there's a kind of backstory within the novel Crime, which is, you know, only about 25% of the novel, which is about Lennox's kind of breakdown in Edinburgh at the hands of this killer before he goes to Miami. So we thought, well, let's take that out of it and make that the series. Let's just inflate that. And that was great for us because, great for me because, you know, I don't really like adapting my own stuff because you feel that somebody else has to come in and do it. You know, I just feel that I need to change a bit, you know, because I don't trust myself to change it because I'm a bit too close to it. So, you know, and that's why Dean, you know, is really great to work with. But the great thing about this was because it was only 25% of what we have, you know, of the book, there was a lot of leeway to redo the characters and to put, you know, proper arcs onto them and just to flesh it out a bit, you know. So that was... that was good fun to do that, you know. So it felt like adapting something, but also felt like writing something original too, you know. So I've kind of got the best of both worlds out of it.
I love that. And another thing that struck me was how little we've seen Edinburgh on TV, because it looks beautiful. It shot your DOP, Will Pugh. The whole show looks amazing, but as a location, as a setting.
Yeah.
It's perfect because I mean, it's got many winding streets. And
I mean, you know, the actors were all brilliant and there was a great cast, but I think, you know, the two of the, you know, the directors were, both of them were great. Like, but the two heroes really, you know, for me were Will and the DOP and Tom, the production designer, you know, because they did such an amazing job, you know, because we said, you know, right from the off, it was like, I said, I talked to us about Dean. I talked to about Dougray and with Tony about it and also Polly and James and David, the directors as well. And we were all adamant that we didn't want it to look like any other British TV drama or TV cop drama. We wanted it to look big and cinematic and... I mean, obviously, you know, sort of, I don't have a TV here, so I've never watched a lot of British television, you know. I didn't want it to be like a British cop drama in any way, and I want to, you know, I was more influenced through by the big, you know, HBO shows in America, you know, and the way that they don't, we've still got this mentality in Britain that everybody's watching this on a 20-inch screen. Basically, you know, stuck in the corner. I mean, people have got like 72-inch screens and, you know, wrap-around sound systems and all that. They don't want everything to be compressed into one little room, you know, with a neon overhead strip and a sort of, you know, and a kind of crappy industrial kind of like dole office desk and all that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we wanted it to be big and cinematic and show the, you know, quite panoramic as well, you know, and show all the different sides of the city, you know, show, posh Georgian crescents of the new town and all that, but also show the schemes and show the and, you know, just get a bit of diversity around it and just get, you know, and so that was you know, they were absolutely fantastic. And, you know, when you think that the level of production that we got out of the budget was absolutely astonishing, and that was due to their craft and their genius, basically.
Yeah And again, it sounds like a dream job to be the production designer, to be wandering around Edinburgh and finding which scene goes where, because it is that kind of city, isn't it? If you've been there, particularly if you've been there drinking on a night out, so many of these alleyways become so cinematic, all these stairs going up here and things like that.
It's a great city to have for that kind of subject matter as well, because it is very gothic with all these kind of twisting sort of wee kind of alleyways and stuff like that. And it's, you know, it's great to be able to use it, you know, to be able to sort of really utilize this as a fascinating place, you know, because I mean, I came back and did lockdown here because I was, you know, I was in the States and like my mum's 92 and all that. I thought I'd better kind of get quite, you know, close, because this lockdown could be quite traumatic for her. So I came back and I hadn't really lived here consistently. I've got a flat here, but I haven't really lived here for any length of time since I was a teen, really. And I just really vibed on it again, because all you can do is walk, around. Yeah. So I've found bits of the city that have kind of been completely transformed. There are other bits that I've forgotten about, and bits I didn't even know, you know, that, you know, and it's just been great sort of getting into this place again and getting really allowing it to sort of to re-inspire me after all these years away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's been, I'd imagine it's been a hell of a journey for you with obviously moving down to London and, as you mentioned, Miami and everything that's happened in between. So we touched upon it earlier, a feeling of almost unworthiness that of how easy it happened for you. So how was it when that hit? Because that's also a lot to deal with the book and the film. And I was at uni at that time, and Trainspotting as a book, as a film, the posters, those characters were a key part of the culture of our lives, kind of thing. So as that being your first attempt and then everything that followed, how did that impact you and how did you balance it, I guess?
I realised quite quickly that when you write a book or you write or you do a film or a play or anything like that, it's a kind of act of giving away. You know, you're taking it out yourself and you're giving it to the world, and you can never be responsible for how it's kind of received. You know, so it's like you've let go of it, you know, and you've kind of let go of it emotionally. And it's really, it's like, I mean, I've met a lot of people that I really admired and looked up to, you know, that I thought were absolute kind of stars and they were kind of heroes of mine and all that. And when I've met them, I've kind of thought that I just want to dive in and ask them about all the stuff that they've done and all that, and how, you know, and tell them how much it impacted on me and all that, you know. And I think, well, and I got to that point of thinking, you know, I've become pals over the years with Iggy Pop, who I absolutely idolised, you know. And I thought, when I first met him, I'm going to tell him how much he means to me, how much all this stuff means to me. And I thought, well, actually, no, because I'm making it all about me. You know, it's all about me. It's how I react to sort of a cultural source, and you know, and he obviously knows that because I've referenced him in the book and I've come to meet him. Just kind of just be cool and start asking him questions and find out about what his life is like now and what he's kind of up to now and all that. And you know, so I sort of you know, it's really flattering that people are interested and so moved by it and all that. But it's all I am is just a kind of a stepping stone on people's personal journey. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
if they hadn't found it through me, they'd have found some other kind of cultural reference or whatever. You know, so it's flattering and it's great that it's been me, but it's really about them. You know, it's about you. It's about how people assimilate and process culture and how they kind of and how they move on through it. And you're just a kind of you're just a kind of enabler, really, I think, because everything is bubbling around in the ether. It's just kind of, it just needs somebody to pull it together, basically.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. So, I mean, crime and obviously Trainspotting, Acid House, Ecstasy, all of these drugs and addiction play a big part in these stories. And I think it's far more common and comfortable to talk about now, but particularly in the Trainspotting days, it wasn't necessarily a pop culture discussion. I mean, I there's another podcast I co-host sometimes called Say Why to Drugs, and that's with a doctor called Dr. Susie Gage, and my role on that is essentially to be the lived experience of many of these drugs, because in my past I've played with a lot of them. I don't choose to do any now, but it feels like a far more comfortable discussion. How's that felt for you over the years, as you initially kind of outrage at you being so blunt and honest and graphic about drug use, to kind of now where maybe it's a lot of shows have that kind of that honesty?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's such an omnipresent thing, and I found it really hard to write about urban life without referencing drugs and drug use, because it just seemed to be, you know, it seemed pretentious not to write about it. That was really, you know, I wasn't sort of, after that happens, you know, people want to talk about drugs all the time. So I didn't want to become a poster boy for sort of, for kind of drugs are brilliant or drugs are shit, or just, you know, have a perspective on drugs and all that. But to me, it was always like, I think the longevity of the stuff that I've done is always because it's, the books are, you know, they're all about transition. They're about transition from one way of life into another, you know. So it's like, and they're basically, that transition is the end of industrialization. It's about the end of paid work, basically. It's how we cope, without work that we get paid for, basically. And that's a big kind of challenge for humanity, you know. So it's like there's that idea of redundancy, you know, that kind of physical and spiritual redundancy. And every time you have a transition in a society, you have something that comes along and fills the gap. You know, it's usually you have a kind of plague, basically, an attendant plague. You know, when you had feudalism to capitalism and everybody's crushed into sort of towns and all that, you have all this kind of hygiene issues. So you have the Black Death and all this kind of stuff coming out. And then now it's like a psychic thing. You're moving into from capitalism into conceptualism where you can't really monetize anything as, you know, other, you know. And then we have the attendant plague is like a kind of the drugs are the attendant plague in that transition, because you know, they take away the pain, you know, the painkillers, but they're also, for instance, for some people, it's about kind of enlightenment and consciousness raising and all that sort of stuff. So everybody has their own way of coping with this kind of societal change, and drugs are part of the mechanism by which we do that, you know, rightly or wrongly. You can use wisely or use unwisely, but that's where they are, you know. And I think that you know, that's part of the resonance for it. But it's more of a, I see these things as more of a, an effect and a cause. You know, the cause is this kind of massive upheaval and social change that we're going through. And the effect is that sort of trying to understand it through, you know, experiencing different levels of consciousness through drugs and trying to negate the pain of it and the loss of it and the hardship of it through anaesthetization through drugs.
Yeah, completely. That I've lived in the same small town in Essex my whole life, and that escapism element, I think, is massive. Like, again, there's a lot of drugs that people do in my area that I'm not a fan of. I've never there's certain drugs I've enjoyed. There's certain drugs I've never been a fan of. But there's never a judgment either, because I also understand the weight of boredom and the weight of mundanity and the weight of all these different things, where it's like, well, I get the idea of needing some kind of escape, and what you choose or what works for you there is understandable. Do you feel, growing up where you grew up, and then train spotting, feeling like it was the first thing to tell the mainstream the stories of these streets, and in your voice, in the Scottish dialect, did you feel a responsibility to keep telling the stories of those streets? But then did you also feel chained to them? Because obviously with things like crime, you did then move away from it and take it to Miami and things like that. What was your relationship with the streets that you were telling these stories on, I guess?
It's something that I've kind of not been really kind of aware about until you kind of hang out with your pals and all that, and they sort of they kind of expect you to be different in a lot of ways, you know. And I was, you know, if a bunch of us get together, we'll, you know, we'll go down the Central Bar in Leith Walk and sit around one of these big seats, about 30 of us, and they'll be looking at me intensely, you know, if I've not been back for a few months or whatever, the kind of and it's almost that kind of thing that they're waiting to see if you've changed in some way, you know. So so what I do is I just, you know, especially coming back from the States, you know, I just play up to it. I say, right, guys, I'm going to hit the restroom. They go, the fucking restroom, you cunt, you fucking... You know, so you'll get a kind of... It breaks the ice, basically. And then, you have a chat about it, and you realise that you obviously have changed in the years and all that. And, you know, it's like, and I'm no longer this man of the streets, and it would be pretentious to kind of to say, you know, but you still hang out with the same people and drink in the same pubs, and you still kind of have all your mates from the scheme and all that, you know. So I never ever, even when I moved, you know, no matter where I've moved to, I've never cut myself off from the people that I've grown up with. You know, it's like probably my two best pals are still my two oldest pals that I've known since I was 6 years old. You know, so I've kind of, you know, you can't really, when you have these kind of long-term relationships, you can't really get too divorced from it, because, you know, people, they know where the bodies are buried, like, you know, they know everything about you, basically. So there's no point in, you know, in trying to have these kind of airs and graces about things. So it's not been a conscious thing. I just haven't separated myself from where I've come from. I've always came back, and I've always hung out, and I've always gone to all the, you know, all the weddings and the funerals and the, you know, everything like that, you know. So it's, and I've all, you know, and the football is a thing that, you know, you kind of, you can meet, instead of going around people individually, you know, all that, you can meet a big bunch of guys.
Yeah.
20, 30 of them, and just have a bit of a tear on a Saturday. So it's all, I've always kept that going. And I don't know, you know, it's like, you know, I suppose it's just part of who I am. You know, you kind of come from a very close-knit community and it just stays with you.
Yeah, completely. Have you found that in your time in America, you become almost almost reactively more Scottish than ever? I know any time I've been working abroad, yeah, or whatever, I swear I come back and I'm the most Cockney guy in the world. I'm not even, I'm South London and Essex, but I think as a fear of losing who I am and where I'm from, when I am away, I become more and more, all right, mate, yeah, no problem, geese.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I had to tone it down a bit in America. I did get a bit kind of wanky transatlantic for a while, but just because nobody understood me, basically. You know, it's like, when you say, like, to somebody in a, you know, in a bar, I'm like, my wife doesn't understand me. It's like, it's not a chat up line. It's actual, you know, it's actual statement of fact. You know, if you, it's like, you know, you do have to sort of tone it down a bit, especially with my accent. But there's certain things you can't explain to Americans. You can't explain why, you know, you can't explain, oh, we've got a queen, we've got a House of Lords, and all this kind of stuff. They look at you and say, what? Fuck, guys, you know. And you say, oh, well, I'm Scottish, but, you know, our parliaments in London were ruled from England. They go, what? You know, they don't kind of understand all this. And it's like, you guys are fucking Muppets, basically. You know, that's the way they, you know, the way they were seen. And it's really interesting. You know, it's like when you get away from, I mean, when I was, like, in the States, I lived in, mainly in Chicago, San Francisco and Miami. I made a conscious decision not to live in either New York or LA because I was going there so much for work, you know, and I got to know the places really well. And I love them, you know, they're great times, but I wanted to really feel as if I lived in America rather than some sort of super metropolitan kind of sort of neoliberal transit sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, completely. It's an interesting one. I always remember Doug Stanhope coming to the UK just after Obama had got in and speaking about how he'd previously had to feel embarrassed about being an American under Bush, like when he'd come to England. But it was like, but of course, I knew you couldn't really judge me because you've got a king and a queen and princes and princesses and all this Game of Thrones mystical nonsense. So, yeah, it makes some sense there. But I guess one of the ways to keep connected and keep on top of these things is social media. And as much as I have my concerns and dislikes of social media, I'm a big fan of your approach to social media, the gleeful vitriol with which you dispense your views is a ray of neon light pollution in a increasingly gloomy cesspit. So it's, how do you find social media? Because it's a weird hole to fall into at times.
It is. You know, it's one of these things that you kind of, you're compelled to take it seriously, but you can't as well, you know. So I let that reflect kind of what I kind of put out there. So I'm like, what I try to do is like when I don't like something or if something kind of winds me up and all that, I counterintuitively feel, you know, I don't know why, but I kind of feel very cheerful about that. You know, I like to be provoked and irritated, and I like to show that I'm irritated, but I like to do it in quite a kind of jocular way, you know. So I think it's just, you know, I think it's fun to just kind of call it, to kind of speak the truth to power and call them out for all the cunts that they are and all that. Just jump in and do it. And it's like a sort of, you know, The thing is that what I very rarely do is have a debate with anybody on Twitter. I'll just make some incendiary statement and then go.
Yeah.
And then you know, you get something. Well, that's not very positive, is it? You have to, you know, how can you defend your position? It's fucking fleeting thoughts. That's all it is. You know what I mean? It's not a place for reasoned debate and discussion. It's bang, fleeting thought, get out there, you know. You know, like fucking Boris Johnson's a cunt. Here's my new fucking, my new book,
yeah,
kind of $9.99 on Amazon or something like that. You know, this is just the way it, you know, and it's not, you know, oh, twerking and all, but it's just the way it is, basically. It's like, this is the way that your thoughts kind of operate, you know, and it, you don't want to spend all day there, and you can't. I love it when you're at train stations and in airports, you can just go, you know, because you're pissed off at airports anyway, especially now. You know, nobody can travel and be happy now, so you're just like, fuck this, yeah. Fuck this, fuck, you know, fuck British Airways, fuck Boris Johnson, you know, fuck Joe Biden or whatever, you know, you can just fire it all out.
I love it. I annoyed someone the other day on Twitter because I expressed an opinion on something, and I made a point at the end of going, but by the way, I'm not looking to debate this. I don't want to convince you. I don't want you to convince me. And someone was all annoyed at, or numerous people were annoyed at that. But my argument was, look, I'm expressing this to people who have chosen to follow me. So they've implied that they want my opinion on, or at least they're interested in my opinion on stuff. That doesn't mean I'm interested in the opinions of hundreds of thousands of strangers. So it's not kind of hypocritical, and I don't see it as an arrogance thing. It's like, oh, I've got an opinion on something, but equally, as you say, I don't want to spend all day on here hearing everyone's opinion on it. I've come to my conclusion. I'm slinging it out there and I'm walking off.
Fire it out. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's like kind of, there was one time that fairly recently that somebody had steamed in and said something, and it was like kind of, and somebody just manifestly proved me wrong, basically. It was just nonsense. You know, what I said was just it was a fleeting impulse, and it wasn't kind of, it wasn't thought through, and it was nonsense. I just wrote, I tweeted back, and I said, like, fair enough, you know, you're right enough. You know, I was kind of completely wrong with that. Like, and it was just like this kind of, you felt this whole, you felt you made, you know, it's like everybody was so sort of nice about it. Oh, that's really good of you. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's like you kind of found that the idea that you have to defend or be invested in this kind of sort of mad impulse that you've had, you know, it's nonsense as well. You know, it's about thoughts, basically. You know, it's about firing out a kind of fleeting thought. So
yeah,
it's you know, and it's strange the way that each of these medium kind of dictate how you are. I mean, I don't do Facebook. I'm only on Twitter and Instagram, and you know, it's that kind of thing that if people sort of saw you on, you know, if people got an impression from you on Twitter, they'd think this guy's a total cunt. You know, and then if you saw you on Instagram, you think this guy is fucking wonderful. He's great. You know, it's the medium. You know, it's like Twitter's just like nah. And Instagram is like, whoa, look at me. Look at my wonderful life. I'm having fun.
I couldn't relate more. That's that sums it up perfectly. Well, I'll start to wrap things up as you've given me a lot of your morning already. But I kind of want to ask what's ahead. And normally that's a tough question for anyone in film or TV or writing, because there's caveats around what you can and can't talk about. But I'm kind of interested in it more than ever here because, as you've said, the pandemic has brought you back to Edinburgh for the first time or to live in Edinburgh for the first time in however many years. Has it changed anything? Has it changed what you want to write about, the stories you want to tell? Has it given you any?
It's a terrible thing to say and all that. I feel always amazingly guilty, because it's been so devastatingly horrible for so many people. But the pandemic's been fucking great for me. You know, it's just been, it's like, because it's, I've had to isolate for so long, and it's like, and that's what you need to do as a writer. You need to isolate. And I'm terrible at that. I'm always going out and disturbing people and and having fun and just like sort of playing around and looking to distract myself. And I couldn't do it in the pandemic. I just had to sit down and smash through it. So I've got a lot of stuff out the road that I've been planning to do for a long time and always been putting up that I never thought I would actually finish, you know. So I've just been incredibly prolific. And it's now I can, you know, it's, I almost feel like I can kick back, you know, because I've got so much stuff in the pipeline that's going to be coming out over the next few years. It gives me a space again, I think, now to... because you always think, you know, you always think you're going to write something that's really brilliant, but you've not done it yet, you know, and that's how I feel, that there's something that I really need to do that I've not done yet. And I feel that once I've done this and I've got stuff out, I'm going to have a good gestation period to think about something that I've not really done before. I want to do something completely different and original. But I've done so much in this last couple of years. You know, I've written two novels, one's coming out next year. I've obviously written the screenplays for Crime with Dean and got that filmed and out. And we're doing the I've kind of got my techno double act with my mate Steve McGuinness, and we've written the songs for the Trainspotting musical, which is starting in December. You know, we wrote a bunch of original songs for it, and I'm writing this novella now with a novella with John King and Alan Warner, which we did a one previously. And you know, so like we set up myself and Carol Lobin from DJ Magazine and Steve have set up a label, basically a record label. So we're going to start releasing stuff, bringing stuff out on that, you know, from different artists. And I've got a big slew of stuff in America as well that I'm getting back across in December to start to work on some of that stuff over there. So it's just been really, really busy for me, and it's been in a great way because I've not been distracted, you know.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thank you very much for your time, man. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat and get into it.
Thank you.
And I said, I adored Crime. My plan originally was I got sent the preview links. I thought I'll watch one or two ahead of the chat because I only had a day or so. Binge the whole lot, just start to finish. Absolutely adored it.
So
good work on that. And as said, thinking about how much fun you and or Deed must have had writing the character of Dougie was the one that stood out for me as writer.
Because I know Jamie who's playing him is a mate, and I thought I can really go to town and just kind of get service, kind of just be in service, basically.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Irvin Welsh, literal living legend in my eyes. That flew by, and I'm really pleased he gave me that amount of time because press junkets and whatnot, it's often a short chat, but he was willing to hand over like an hour or so of his time, and that's always a beautiful thing. So hope you enjoyed that. Next week, we got a cheeky two-parter, but I'll tell you more about that when it comes. So, until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.